This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Okay, imagine me doing my best Janet Yellen impression. I am writing to inform you, the Treasury Secretary wrote today, that beginning on Thursday, January 19, 2023, the outstanding debt of the United States is projected to reach the statutory limit. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, January the 13th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. All right, obviously, I don't have a good Janet Yellen impression, number one. But also number two, next Thursday is 6 days away, which is to say we are all going to be hearing a lot about the debt limit, perhaps a lot sooner than we'd have chosen. That quote, as I said, was from a letter the Treasury Secretary sent to congressional leaders this morning. And we will talk about it and the economic week that was with Kate Davidson. She is at Bloomberg. Sadeep Reddy is at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Kate, let me start with you. And I want to start not with the debt limit. We'll get there in a minute. But I want to start with the Consumer Price Index. Inflation came out yesterday. 6.5% the headline, 5.7% the core, less food and energy, of course. That is a meaningful deceleration. My question to you is it a durable deceleration?
Well, that's the big question, Kai, right? But Fed officials, they seem to be pretty optimistic about it. Of course, they've been burned before, right? You remember last year, there were a couple times where it looked like inflation might have peaked. Some of us may have written stories that it might have peaked.
I'm completely sure I asked you on this program whether it had peaked, and you're like, I don't know.
I don't want to know what I said. Yeah. So it's not just Fed officials; they're just like us, right? They don't know for sure, but it's definitely an encouraging sign. That's what we heard a couple of them say this week. There's reason for hope, and I think that they're feeling pretty good that all these interest rate increases that they've been working toward, that have been filtering through the economy, we're starting to see them working, and they might be getting to a place where they can back off some of those and just see inflation hopefully start to continue coming down.
All right, Sadeep, let me ask you about what some of those Fed officials have said. I'm thinking specifically here about Rafael Bostic, the president of the Boston Fed, who said this week, you know what, we need to get the terminal rate, the ending point of the Fed rate hike cycle, to 5% and let it sit there for a good long while. So that's number one. Number two, Susan Collins, the new-ish president of the Boston Fed, said, yeah, you know what? I'm leaning toward a quarter percentage point hike at the next meeting, which is the end of this month. The Fed communication chop is usually pretty well-oiled, and I think that it was an interesting sort of dichotomy right there.
Yeah, everybody knows that they need to get rates up and keep them up, and they need to be very clear that they're not going to start cutting rates at the first sign of trouble. That is their challenge. The moment you see some softening in the labor market, just like we've seen softening inflation, all the markets go crazy, create a little bit more frothy challenges with stocks, with meme stocks running this week, with all sorts of things that are not good. They need to put a lid on all of this. And put a lid on some of the chatter that they're gonna calm down on this campaign. But you don't need to keep whacking the economy. And so they're trying to say, we get it, we understand that the numbers are coming in better, but we're not declaring victory. That is the only way they're going to get through this without having to do this mess twice. And they know they only want to do it once.
Right. It's worth a mention here, Kate, that over the last three-ish or so months, inflation is like 3%.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting sort of look if you break up the past year. I mean, at the beginning of the year, inflation was very high, but right, we're looking at the past 5 or 6 months here. There's a noticeable downward trend, but I think Fed officials, they have this really big communications challenge right now, which Deepa is kind of getting at. You know, they really have to get markets to believe that they are going to stick with it. That means, you know, they're not going to back off and cut rates at the first sign that the labor market is weakening. So you know, they're being really cautious, even in just in how they're talking about these positive signs, these optimistic signs on inflation.
I thought it was interesting, Sudeep. Sorry, one more Fed thing, and then we'll move on. It was interesting in the minutes that came out last week how open the governors were and the members of the Federal Open Market Committee were about communicating their message to the markets. They're really paying attention to what the markets are doing.
Yeah, we're at this point in the economic cycle where what's happening in the markets is actually really adjusting and changing company behavior. It's at that point, and when you have that interplay, that is actually the sweet spot for the Fed, because what they're saying can actually lead to company-wide, economy-wide changes that aren't the kind of devastating, shocking things that whack the job market, but they're kind of like the tweaks that allow them to dial up and dial down in a very careful way. It's rare to see this happen this way. It doesn't actually last for that long for them to be able to have that ability, but that's where they are right now.
A word here, Kate, about the American consumer. We got from the good people at the University of Michigan today, consumer sentiment, which was up. Inflation expectations are anchored. Consumers still and all are feeling pretty good.
They are feeling pretty good. You know, gas prices, which have a huge sort of huge impact on this particular survey, I think on sentiment in general, they've fallen sharply from the highs that we saw over the summer. Grocery inflation has slowed, and jobless claims, unemployment is still very low. I mean, the labor market is really resilient. So yeah, consumers feeling pretty good about that. And I think they still do have a little bit of a cash cushion. They're starting to spend that down, but that's helping them as well.
Okay, Sudeep, the debt limit. Yellen sends this letter today that says January 19th is the date. Probably sometime in June-ish will be the real date, because she's got a bunch of bookkeeping things that she can do to keep the United States solvent, as it were. Honestly, and this I'm dead serious here, my note to myself on this to talk to you guys about is, really? We're doing this again?
We're doing this again, for goodness sake, we are, and it's going to be, I can't believe we're going to spend the next 6 months talking about this nonsense, but we are, and it's going to take something to shake the system and force it to actually get resolved, but this will be the parlor game of figuring out how to get there.
Let me ask you this, scale of 1 to 10, and I'm going to ask you both, scale of 1 to 10, based on our previous experiences with debt limit fights, scale of 1 to 10, how uptight are you about this one? Sudeep, you go first.
This one is scale of 1 to 10. I only give it a 5 because we know how it ends. It's not going to be perfectly clean. I don't think this ends with an earth-shaking default on the debt, but it's not going to be easy. It's going to require some turmoil. It's been 12 years since we had to go through this. It was a very difficult moment for the economy and markets back when we were going through it then. This is not a great moment for bond markets and stock markets to be going through this now. So it's not going to be pretty, but I think it will get done.
Kate, same question.
Yeah, I'd probably say I'm slightly more anxious than Sudeep. I'd give it maybe a 6 or 7 because I completely agree. It's going to get resolved. It always does. But the economic backdrop right now is just so different than it was in previous debt limit episodes. And so I think there's a lot more volatility and there's potential for markets to get a lot more cranky about this. And that's not great.
It is interesting to me, and we are out of time, so we'll have to take this up again because we're going to talk about this again. Neither of you cited the political backdrop, which I think is the difference factor this time. But that is for another day. Sudeep Reddy at Politico, Kate Davidson now at Bloomberg. Thanks, you too.
Thanks, Kai.
Wall Street on this Friday of a 3-day weekend up, but, you know, nobody was wild about it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's not quite the vernal equinox we're all waiting for, that change of seasons from winter to spring, but the big Wall Street bank started fourth quarter earnings season today, so that's something. The quick rundown goes like this. J.P. Morgan profits up 6%, Bank of America up 2%, Wells Fargo profits down 50%, 50%, as it took a nearly $4 billion charge for a settlement with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Citigroup profits off 21%, but somehow that still beat expectations. There is no expectation here that you remember each of those earnings. They are kind of all over the place and really not all that memorable individually. But together, they can tell us some things about how the economy's doing and how much risk there might be of it doing worse later on this year. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Back on Monday, when I previewed today's earnings reports, Karen Petru at Federal Financial Analytics had this to say.
Banks are canaries in the economic coal mine.
Well, so far, in the face of high inflation, rising interest rates, and a slowing economy, the canary's still singing.
So far, the banking industry overall has done pretty well.
Banking consultant Bert Ely says the big banks are increasing how much cash they put aside to cover losses on loans.
The big uncertainty hanging over banking is what's going to happen in the economy. If we have a serious recession, then some of them may be struggling.
Right now, consumers are still in pretty good shape. But savings are dwindling and credit card balances are rising, says Greg McBride at Bankrate.
You're seeing credit card rates that have already moved to a record high and are still likely to increase further.
And banks are getting ready for worse times to come, says equity analyst Eric Compton at Morningstar.
Delinquencies, charge-offs, loan losses are still relatively low. However, they're finally starting to go back up again. We aren't seeing any sort of recessionary levels, but the strain is finally starting to increase a little bit.
One area of increasing weakness is investment banking. In the midst of a market downturn and rising interest rates, says Infrastructure Capital Advisors Jay Hatfield, himself a former investment banker.
Investment banking is a very cyclical business. Having been one, I can attest to that. When the market's way down, investment bankers stop doing new equity issuance.
That's led to a slump in fees and a wave of layoffs as the new year begins. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The beleaguered crypto industry. Think FTX, the collapse in the price of Bitcoin, layoffs spreading across the industry. Need I go on? Beleaguered crypto is getting a little bit more beleaguered. This week, the Securities and Exchange Commission announced it's suing two crypto exchanges, Genesis Global Capital and Gemini Trust Company by name, for the, quote, unregistered offer and sale of securities to retail investors. Now, there are all sorts of allegations and personal attacks flying back and forth between founders and investors, but we are going to take that item as a jumping off point to observe that this is just the latest effort by federal regulators to regulate an industry that is largely not. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more on that one.
The SEC says the Gemini Earn program, which basically let consumers loan out their crypto earnings in exchange for interest, should have been registered with the agency. It wasn't, but Gemini and Genesis raised billions of dollars from hundreds of thousands of investors who still can't access their money.
The very particular issue in the case about whether or not this was a lending product that needs to be regulated is not a highly controversial issue.
J.W. Verrett at George Mason's Antonin Scalia Law School is a former advisor for the SEC. The controversial issue, he says, is how the SEC is going about all this. Absent more comprehensive regulations, they're enforcing laws not specifically designed for crypto.
We won't tell you what is and is not a security in crypto, but when we see you step into one of these hidden traps, we'll get you.
Now, of course, the SEC would probably beg to differ with that perspective. Will Song, a professor of finance at Cornell, says he understands where the crypto companies are coming from.
But if we take a step back and look at the bigger picture, there are challenges for the regulatory bodies.
The industry is changing rapidly, much faster than regulators and certainly faster than Congress can keep up with.
For example, you don't want to issue a set of rules and then change them 2 months later. So we almost have to wait for the industry to evolve a little bit, then to figure out what set of rules that should be, without changing it too frequently.
In the meantime, Song expects even more action from regulators when it comes to crypto, because there's a lot of pressure here in D.C. for a lot more oversight. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, a filter that goes over your face that says, what Disney princess are you?
I don't know. You guys tell me. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 112 points today, a third of 1%, 34,302. The NASDAQ added 78 points, about 0.7%, 11,079. The S&P 500 up 15 points, 0.4%, 3,999. On the S&P 500. For the week, the Dow up 2%. The NASDAQ added 4.8%. The S&P 500 up 2.7%. We heard from Mitchell about big bank earnings. So looking at some that landed today, JPMorgan Chase rose 2.5%. Bank of America grew 2.2%. Citigroup advanced 1.7%. Yesterday, you might remember, if you were paying attention during the numbers, that used car dealer Carvana had a crazy good stock day. But today, the Wall Street Journal reports the company is cutting jobs and is $7 billion in debt. Carvana skidded 12% today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. As I alluded to when I was setting up Kimberly's story, you don't have to have had more than a passing familiarity with the news the past year or so to know that crypto has been in the spotlight in a very unpleasant way. And the crash in the price of Bitcoin, off 70% since late 2021, has also hit the once mighty crypto mining industry, which generates Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies using just a lot of computing power, which in turn uses just a lot of electricity. Some states and municipalities have been trying real hard to lure mining companies to their neck of the woods for years now. Others are less enthused. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more now on the state of crypto mining.
The crypto contingent at this month's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas seemed eager to show it's not fazed by the current moment. Speakers on a panel called How to Stay Warm in a Crypto Winter were introduced this way.
These are not individuals who jumped in the last 2 years during all of the craziness.
No crypto tourists here.
But really the crypto OGs.
This crypto winter started early last year, months before the November collapse of FTX and the arrest of founder Sam Bankman-Fried. From the CES convention floor, Sheila Warren, CEO of the industry group Crypto Council for Innovation, acknowledged those events haven't helped public perceptions, but
the thing I'm certainly seeing here at CES is that this isn't going away. It is definitely here to stay.
Here to stay, but certainly in trouble. That's especially true for the businesses that make their money mining cryptocurrencies. Across North America, shares in many of those firms have crashed, falling 90% or more over the last year. That includes Canada's Bitfarms, where Ben Gagnon is the chief mining officer.
The biggest thing is probably just the Bitcoin price in general. It's fundamentally a different business when your revenue is cut by 70%.
Meanwhile, the cost of a key input shot up as the global energy crisis set in, says Ben Harper of Luxor Technologies, which provides software services to the industry.
You have this huge increase in power prices that's happened over the last year, and that's squeezed margins from the cost side.
Back when times were good, crypto mining farms like this sprawling and very loud facility we visited in Messina, New York a year ago, were plowing cash into more mining computers. Stacks of them were set to be installed. These days, more machines are chasing the same prize, says Luxor's Harper.
The more mining on the number of fixed coins, obviously the less revenue there is for any miner.
Their collective crash has been welcomed by environmental groups organizing against energy-intensive crypto mining.
No frack gas for Bitcoin mining!
In upstate New York, the group Seneca Lake Guardian helped push for the nation's first statewide partial moratorium on new crypto mining, arguing those projects are at odds with New York's carbon reduction goals. Yvonne Taylor says crypto's travails have helped her group gain traction in their local fight against a crypto miner operating at a fossil fuel power plant in their community.
it's pretty validating because, you know, we've been raising the alarm and shouting our concerns at the top of our lungs for literally years about this facility.
North of the border, two Canadian provinces, Manitoba and Quebec, are using different tactics to limit crypto mining. And even though there are still some green pastures for miners, including states that offer subsidies to them, crypto investor Bradley Tusk of Tusk Ventures warns the industry needs a wake-up call.
They need to get much more politically sophisticated. If they don't start to be smarter, more proactive, and more aggressive, and they're going to be completely banned from doing what they do entirely.
Tusk says that's true for crypto miners and the crypto industry as a whole.
If you don't step up, you're going to get wiped out.
Although there's new legislation to crack down on crypto mining nationally, for opponents like Tom Smar, a senior attorney at Earth Justice, the effort against the industry has largely been a state-by-state fight.
They're chasing electricity prices. They're looking to use large volumes of electricity, regardless of where it comes from, at a very critical time for our country's policies on climate.
He says even after a rough year, there's still plenty of crypto mining activity. If the crypto miners lose in one state or province, many are prepared to pack up and move to another. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
We're going to turn to another side of tech now, Instagram, which, along with a lot of other platforms in that slice of this economy, has changed quite a bit over the years. Most recently for Instagram, with the introduction of Instagram Reels a couple of years ago. They are basically short videos reminiscent of, in that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery and hoping to make a buck kind of way, TikTok. Jacob Sweet noticed a Reels trend not too long ago, and he wrote about it for The New Yorker. Jacob, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so Instagram, I can talk about. Instagram Reels, I can talk about. I need to know, though, what a face filter video is.
Yeah, face filter video. I started seeing these a lot last year, and it can be anything from, you know, a filter that goes over your face that says, what Disney princess are you? Or what zodiac sign is your true love? And then you press a button, and it'll flash a few options, and then it'll give you your answer. You know, maybe you're Snow White. There's a lot of different kinds of face filters, but the one I was most interested in were these random sort of ones.
Wow. All right. So we'll get to the why of it in a minute. But the reason we're talking to you is that these things get millions and millions of views.
Yeah, I just started seeing a lot of them with tens of millions of views, hundreds of millions of views. And often it was the simplest ones that were getting all these views. It was just, what is my fortune for 2022? And it'll say, you know, not good. And it'll get, you know, 80 million views or something like that. Just things simple as that. And I just started seeing that all over my timeline.
Okay. The way the internet works is that all of these views translate into dollars. How does that part of this work?
Yeah. So in later 2021, Instagram was really trying to compete with TikTok and YouTube. And they opened this program called the Reels Play Bonus, where basically creators would get paid for the amount of views people can get on their videos.
Like how much money? Like, should I think about a career change?
Maybe. I don't know. My mom asked me the same thing when I told her that people were making, you know, $10,000+ on the app per month. So yeah, I mean, it was a big range of the people I talked to. Some people were making six-figure stuff per year, and some were making, you know, a few thousand.
Okay, so this is going to sound pejorative, but it's really not. These things are silly is a polite way to put it. Even the people who do them think they're silly. Why do you think they're so spectacularly successful?
I think that it is a really short form video, so it gets this really good replay value. Also, you know, inherently it has a really, you know, appealing format. You get on, it asks you a question, and you might want to wait 3 or 4 seconds to see that answer. It's appealing in that way. And also, Instagram really wanted people to create material from the features that already existed on the site. And the Instagram filters, you know, are made for Instagram specifically. So I think that got a little bit of a boost as well.
Instagram decided, as you said, that it was worth it to them to pay the money to people to do these face filter videos to get more people on the platform. And that makes sense, I suppose, to a point. But is there a limit to how long Instagram can keep paying for this stuff and to get more eyeballs? Maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. I mean, the people I talk to who are making these filters, the most prolific creators, they didn't really know who was watching their videos. Hmm. And I think that Instagram, they're starting to notice that a lot of the comments on these filters are really negative. It's a lot of people saying, you know, please stop showing this on my feed. I hate this stuff. So I do think Instagram's algorithm is improving over time and that people will and are stopping this. Right. But, you know, whenever these new sites are promoting a new feature, there's always this period of inefficiency where people find this little hack and they use that to make a lot of money.
Right. All right, put up or shut up time. Do you spend a lot of time watching these things or what? I mean, like aside from your professional life, because this is kind of your job, but in real life?
Well, you know, when I was writing this piece, I had to watch quite a lot of them. And kind of the unfortunate thing about reporting on a lot of social media trends is that they see that you're watching them and they're like, you know what? We think you like this. Here's more and more. But I don't watch too many of them. And the funny thing is that a lot of the people that are making them, they don't watch them either.
Jacob Sweet, he covers internet culture, most recently in The New Yorker, about the Instagram Reels gold rush. That's the name of the piece. Jacob, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, before which I'm obliged to remind you that correlation is not causality, but sometimes they are really, really close. There is news today that Tesla is cutting prices a lot, in some cases 20%, trying to jumpstart sales in the face of a newly competitive electric vehicle market. Here is the additional data point that might be helpful in your analysis of this. The company's shares are off 65% over the past 12 months. All right, here is your moment of economic context. We started with Janet Yellen. We will end with Janet Yellen. Here is the close to that debt limit letter that she sent Congress today. "I respectfully urge," the Treasury Secretary wrote, "Congress to act promptly to protect the full faith and credit of the United States." Sincerely, Janet Yellen, Secretary of the Treasury. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.